discuss defunding the police. Welcome to CBS Episode 7, Carceral Casteism. The only thing we take seriously here is full annihilation. Uncertainty keeps political prisoners hanging between hope and hopelessness. Umar Khalid's prison letter, published in Outlook magazine on the 17th of January 2022. I have also realized that a Muslim is always seen as part of one large national, or rather a transnational group. They are bereft of any individuality. So many questions posed to him or remarks passed to him are not about him but about aap log, you people. Are aap log mein to aisa hota hai na? ये आप लोग ने क्या कर दिया अफगानिस्तान में? आप नहीं क्यों ओवैसी के बारे में कुछ नहीं बोलते? अरे आप लोग में तो ऐसे ही होता है ना? None of the above comments I have faced at different times has come from consciously hateful people or people for whom hate is a political agenda. Instead, they've come from ordinary and otherwise nice people. People who come and share their food with you, who tell you stories of how they landed in jail and ask for legal advice. It is not that I am discovering prejudice, bigotry, or even hate for the first time. Over the last 5 years, the regime and its Pied Pipers in media have constantly reminded me of my Muslimness and the place of Muslims in New India. Till now, hate came from a distance, usually from TV and mobile screens. I always had the option of switching it off if it got too much. My immediate circle, the people I spent time with in real life, sheltered me from hate. Jail has removed this distance. Now hate and prejudice are up close and in my face. There is nobody to shelter me and nobody to confide in. Umar Khalid, I assume if you're already listening to this, you know who he is. But on the off chance that you don't, he's an activist currently booked under the Unlawful Activities Prevention Act. His letter marked 467 days or 15 months of his being an under trial in Asia's largest prison, Tihar Jail. And like the good Delhi boy intellectual he is, he closes his letter with Faiz Ahmed Faiz's A Prison Evening. Though they may concoct the tyranny's poisons, they will have no victories. Not today, not tomorrow. So what if they douse the flame in rooms where lovers meet? If they are so mighty, let them snuff out the moon.
From the experience of last year, and it was subsequently confirmed that those arrested under UAPA will not be eligible for any interim relief. The only way for us to be back with our families is to secure bail, which provisions of UAPA make extremely difficult, if not impossible, for the near future. As a law, the UAPA makes mockery of the Supreme Court's observation that bail is the rule and jail an exception. For all effective purposes, the UAPA turns this principle on its head by requiring an accused person to prove their innocence and thereby proceeding on a presumption of guilt even in order to grant bail. That too, without the benefit of a trial. It feels as though it is only after a long-drawn trial that we can even expect to be free. Since the first arrest in our case, our trial has not even begun. All 16 of us arraigned in this conspiracy case are in pre-trial detention, and the pandemic will only further delay the proceedings. Clearly, the process itself is the punishment, and this process torturously slow even in normal times.
The summer of 2020 destroyed my whole idea of time. 2019 made me start timelining my life not according to the Gregorian calendar, but the pace and rhythm of political turmoil. Still, that heady, painful, sticky, sick summer is what melted and unspooled my days and nights. That's really when the precursor to CBS was conceived. I was doing a class on revolutions in Pacific time while physically in Kathmandu. Black Lives Matter was raising through a lot of the social media sort of sphere, never mind everything else that was going down closer to home. And it was a painful time to be alive. And that was when abolition sort of entered the mainstream vocabulary, whatever that means. It didn't take me that long to sort of absorb this non-carceral form of thinking, this killing the cop in my head, not because I read a lot of Angela Davis or anything, but because I didn't have to shoot a whole platoon of cops, just one old uncle with a rifle. There was always one of them stationed, I guess, at the gate where my school bus stop was in Delhi. I could never fathom a reason as to why this precise stop necessitated the presence of a heavily armed and armored police officer. It was just a little intersection where kids from my school would line up every morning. I asked my mom if she'd ever heard about abolition, and she gave me her owlish look and said she obviously had. Context: my mom studied social work for her master's, and that got me thinking, well, yeah, abolition is the way to go. I grew up in Delhi, so I've also grown up being intensely paranoid about my safety, and one of the pieces my mom firmly impressed on me and my sister was...
When our kids were small, we had moved to Delhi, and I was quite paranoid about their safety. So they learned to, you know, kind of tell their father's name, address, phone number, and, you know, kind of told about a stranger danger, like don't talk to strangers and all that. But I used to be worried about, like, what would happen if they get separated from us, if they get lost at a mall or a marketplace, or then they would have to talk to somebody. But, you know, who would that person be? And I literally had no idea, because I don't think my parents actually, you know, had any kind of protocol or family rule about this. So I looked up, you know, looked for information online. And I mean, this is 20, 25 years ago. So most of the kind of parenting content would be from the West. So the first option given there would be like, find a policeman, you know, or go to the police station. And I think that is something that I never wanted to tell my children that, you know, that did not seem like a safe or a sensible option for me. I mean, neither as a child nor as an adult, as a woman, would I have thought that, oh, if I have a problem, let me just march up to the police station and, you know, or find a policeman and my problem would be solved, right? And so the second option is what we went with, which is usually, you know, find a family, find a woman with children, find, you know, an older lady and ask them if you can use a phone, make a phone call and contact us. I mean, I think it's quite common in India, no matter how blameless and innocent you are, the arrival or the sight of the police, it's something that you feel, you know, safe about or something that you're comfortable about. I can't imagine, like, kids or, you know, some woman entering a police station alone. I mean, it sounds more like the beginning of some scary movie than, you know, a place of people going and getting the help they need. And even when we do go there, you know, with other people, you know, for some passport work or something like that, I mean, it's pretty menacing, right?
This is a spoiler though. I've jumped a little too ahead. Right now, we're still talking about Umar Khalid, he of the JNU speeches, Vice video highlight, Harshmandir's stamp of approval and the revolution's hottest product. We're still talking about political prisoners. Ambedkar wrote briefly on political prisoners in his 1943 speech, Ranade, Jinnah and Gandhi. Courting prison has become an act of martyrdom in India. It is regarded both as a patriotic act and an act of courage. Most people who would otherwise be beneath notice, and in whose case it could be rightly told that they were scoundrels who had taken to politics as their last refuge, have, by going to prison, become martyrs and have acquired a name and fame, which, to say the least, is quite astounding. There would be some substance in this view if prison life involved the rigors men like Tilak and those of his generation had been subjected to. Prison life today has lost all of its terrors. It has become a mere matter of detention. Political prisoners are no longer treated as criminals. They are placed in a separate class. There are no hardships to suffer, there is no reputation to lose, and there is no privation to undergo. It calls for no courage. But even when prison life had, as in the time of Mr. Tilak, its rigors, the political prisoners could not claim greater courage than a social reformer. Most people do not realize that society can practice tyranny and oppression against an individual to a far greater degree than a government. The means and scope open to the community for pressure are more extensive than those available to the government. They are far more effective. What punishment in the penal code is comparable in magnitude and severity to excommunication? Who has greater courage, the social reformer who challenges society and invites upon himself excommunication, or the political prisoner who challenges government and incurs sentence of a few months or a few years imprisonment? Another difference is often lost in estimating the courage shown by the social reformer and the political patriot. When the social reformer challenges society, no one can hail him a martyr. There is no one even to befriend him. He is loathed and shunned. But when the political patriot challenges government, he has the whole society to support him. He is praised, admired, and elevated as the savior. Who shows more courage? The social reformer who fights alone or the political patriot who fights under a cover of a vast mass of supporters? It would be idle to deny that Ranadive showed courage in taking up the cause of social reform. Indeed, he demonstrated a high degree of courage. For let it be remembered, he lived in times when social and religious customs, however gross and immoral, were regarded as holy. And when any doubt questioning their divine and moral basis was regarded not merely as heterodoxy, but as intolerable blasphemy and sacrilege. In an earlier interview on the 19th of September 2019, on Vandit Jain's broadcast Lights, Camera, Azadi, Dalit Supreme Advocate Disha Wadekar explained what it meant to be from what she termed a dissenting community. The dissent she refers to here is her community's vibrant history of resisting colonial policies related to Jal Jungle Zameen or tribal water, forests and land ownership. This resistance made them classified as criminal tribes under the British Raj and institutionalized mechanisms of detentions, invasions, forced labor, disenfranchisement, portrayed to maintain social order. Vimukta Jati are the tribes listed initially under the Colonial Era Criminal Tribes Act of 1871. Being notified as a criminal meant that all members of the tribe were made to register with the local magistrate. Not registering was a chargeable crime under the Indian Penal Code. The Criminal Tribes Act was repealed in 1949, which is to say those communities numbering more than 200 tribes were now denotified. According to Wadekar, this is the history of Adivasis in the country. She went on to say that India gained independence in 1947, but the criminal tag was only removed in 1952 when the communities were denotified. I'm very Christian, culturally and intellectually speaking, and all of this sounds to me like the miracle of transubstantiation.
Transubstantiation, Latin, transubstantiatio, Greek, metasiosis, metasiosis, is, according to the teachings of the Roman Catholic Church, the change of substance or essence by which the bread and wine offered in the sacrifice of the sacrament of the Eucharist during the Mass become, in reality, the body and blood of Jesus Christ.
The change of the whole substance of the bread into the substance of the body of Christ and the whole substance of wine into his blood. It also was an alchemical theory, that is to say, the changing of one substance wholly into another. Lead to gold, water to wine, bread to body, under trial to political prisoner, notified to denotified, person to criminal, collaborator to founding father, British Raj to independent India. Of course, transubstantiation and alchemy are both complete bunkery. I'll let you draw your own conclusions about Roman Catholicism. It's like post-coloniality, like the idea of it. How can we say colonialism is over? Look at the world around us. Look at the way it crumbles. How can we say that colonialism is over? The Shas community is still defined as denotified. My community officially are still called scheduled castes. Who schedules? To paraphrase one of our starlit heroes, Shaheed Rohit Vemula, taken from us way too soon, who are any of these people trying to reduce us to our immediate identities and nearest possibilities? To votes, to numbers, to things.
Fear. It lurks within the human mind, waiting to take control. Fear, both real and imagined, is at work within this story, a story written by Ursula K. Le Guin. Listen, as Sci-Fi Radio explores the various levels of fear in Diary of the Rose.
When we think about the history of policing, I think that most people are familiar with the racial and capitalist context of the US. Upper caste international student activists and self-proclaimed diaspora community organizers tweet about dissent have so much to say about Angela Davis, fuck the police and the prison industrial complex. Summer 2020 was really such a time of caste blindness and rootless performances of allyship in the brown and POC online communities, which is, again, not meaningless, but immaterial. As for me, my heart was breaking watching the ramping up of arrests of the BK16 and the government-created tragedy of the migrant exodus. I was also trying to do classes on a 12-hour time difference, so that summer passed by me in a haze of sleep deprivation and grief. I was also physically in Kathmandu, which is awash with ferment and rage. Just like the whole subcontinent, the rates of discrimination, abuse, killings and violence against caste-oppressed people had exponentially increased during the lockdowns. But historical resistance was building in the shape of a nascent Nepali Dalit Lives Matter campaign. A movement, really. I could say this whole spiel about the value of being relevant and connected to your context, but honestly, I've never given a damn about America. I instead set out to read up about the history of policing, criminalization, and its mutually enriching relationship with caste in India. So here's the 101. Since the 1870s, various pieces of colonial legislation in India during British rule were collectively called the Criminal Tribes Act. They were attached to varying regions and targeted different communities, but their mechanism worked by criminalizing entire communities. These communities were targeted because of their dissent and resistance to colonial control and forms of ownership. This was prompted by the colonial orders to designate them under the constructed concept of habitual criminals. They didn't really distinguish between tribes and castes or ethnic and social communities, but they were all defined under these oppressive legal vocabularies, addicted to the systematic commission of non-bailable offences. In his prison letter, Umar Khalid wondered if rampant and normalized Islamophobia really is the legacy of Midnight's children, which personally I think is a very overwrought Savarna reaction, even if the guy is in jail right now. What I want to know, or rather what I want Savarnas to ponder, is what the hell does independence mean? What does the republic stand for? If we're really going to talk about Midnight's children, let's talk about the ones still in the dark. More than 60 million people live under the violence enacted and sustained by these bad laws. Surveillance, targeting, control, enforced order. According to many scholars, this tight control was placed on these communities to ensure that no future revolts could take place. The CBA project works primarily with the Pardi community, who were and are traditionally semi-nomadic forest-dwelling hunters. In that phenomenal and crucial paper published last May, Settled Habits, New Tricks, Casteist Policing Meets Big Tech in India, for the Transnational Institute, Ameya Bokil, Nikita Sonavani, Rujana Bej, Vaishali Janarthan, and Avanindra Kare. I quote them here. The idea of hereditary criminals still occupies the mind and structure of the Indian police, largely comprising members of oppressive castes. The deadly legacy of the Criminal Tribes Act has endured in policing structures, practices, and attitudes. The violence of the Indian police system is sustained through vagueness in the legislative language and what the CPA project calls vast discretionary powers that are granted to the policing systems. Both their existence and systematic exploitation have been invisibilized. Scholars have failed to document the systemic police targeting of Pardis and other DNT communities, while civil society's attempts to highlight the issue have been restricted to anecdotal evidence of police brutality. I was fortunate enough to talk to Nikita and Sanjana about the incredible and crucial work they do.
My name is Nikita. I am a lawyer and co-founder of the Criminal Justice and Police Accountability Project. We're a group based out of Bhopal, and we work on the question of the casteist policing and their targeting of oppressed caste communities. And we're trying to push for police accountability and decarceration.
My name is Sanjana Mishra. I'm from Bhandara district of Maharashtra. I did my law school from Government Law College, Mumbai. I graduated in 2019. Then I did litigation for some time, then pandemic happened, and then I started work with Nikita and with CPA project.
The front page of the CPA project's website says that the very existence of the prison forecloses the kinds of discussions that we need in order to imagine the possibility of eradicating these behaviors. The Delhi Police Special Cell accused Umar Khalid of being a conspirator in what they call the Delhi riots case because of his so-called provocative speeches. This special cell is putting in resources and labor into investigating this apparent multi-layered conspiracy that they think is behind it all.
Fear. As tensions remain high in Delhi, the national capital, a battleground.
At least 34 people have been killed in the violence over 3 days, while nearly 200 have been left injured.
I wasn't even in the city, but I watched it all unfold in real time. I will never forget the death toll numbers going up. I will never forget Hindu destruction, Hindu violence, Hindu impunity. See, whatever delusion the Delhi police is laboring under, that's not a conspiracy. How many pages of so-called evidence they pull up, the truth we saw with our own eyes doesn't change.
The state creates condition that would lead to harm. Where we work in Bhopal, like there will be people from the Vimukta communities who will say that, like, I want a job. You are telling me I should get like a decent paying, whatever, a job that where I'm able to make money honestly. I want to do that. But you tell me, the moment people hear the last name Pardhi, Kanjar, Kuch Bandhya, nobody is going to give us a job. You're kicked out of school. You go to the marketplace, you will be under surveillance. Like, every aspect of your life is engulfed with that sort of vision of criminality to make sure that you have no, absolutely no way of doing anything that will not lead to any kind of destructive action, right? So then you resort to substance abuse, you resort to theft, and you resort to different kinds of harmful acts that then the state terms as crime, and then, you know, then you're subsequently incarcerated for that, right? So then it's like the conditions are created by the state so that we are all distracted from what those conditions are. This category of crime has been cultivated, and that there are these people then who are going to be treated as criminals, and then are, it is state's divergent tactic, right? Because then the moment you say, okay, but like two people who are playing cards on the street or like are addicted to gambling, because like look at their working conditions, look at the fact that they have no other avenue to want to do better for themselves, that all of this is happening because they're all part of a structure where occupation is assigned by birth, their access to opportunities is cut off. They don't want you to arrive at that, right? So you create a spectacle of this. First, it started by saying, oh yeah, we need a body to keep these people in order. So you have the police. Then you say, okay, it is not enough to keep them in order. It's not just enough that you have a body that's like disciplining and watching over them. You need to put them all in one place where their movement and liberties are curbed. You know, that's how you discipline them, by confinement. And then you have prison. Then, of course, we didn't have enough of that. So we said, okay, actually, let's just get rid of these people altogether. No, let's just like kill them. It's like the goalpost keeps shifting, no? First, it's like, yeah, you need harsher punishment. Then you say, no, actually, the burden of proof in the law needs to change. So let us, like, this burden of proof is too high. It's just that it keeps shifting so that nobody will ever arrive at the fact that actually this is happening because, look, these are the conditions that exist. And you make, like, this a spectacle of these individuals in order to be able to do that. I mean, for the lack of a better phrase, like, that's the state's game plan.
I'm Dalita, and since my childhood I have seen how caste is, and I am from a village. So gaon mein bhi hamara ghar gaon ke bahar hai. So that was my first thing jab mujhe laga ki hum log ka ghar bahar kyun hai. Aur jab bhi hum log train se bhi travel karte the, jab kisi bhi gaon ki entry ho rahi hai, to you will see Buddha Vihars, Ambedkar statues. So I used to feel very much proud initially. कि देखो अपन जब भी कोई कोई गांव जाते हैं तो अपने को बाबा साहब की फोटो दिखता है ना, मूर्ति दिखती है. I used to feel proud as a child. But then as I grew up, I understood कि नहीं, this is the case, right? कि हम लोग बाहर ही रहेगा, outskirts में ही हम लोग रहेंगे. We are not allowed to live in the center of a city. When I moved to Mumbai for law, I got to know कि caste urban में कैसे play कर रहा है, right? So I was a bit confident while moving कि ठीक है, law school जा रहे हैं तो उस तरीके का डिस्क्रिमिनेशन या उस तरीके का एक्सक्लूसिव बिहेवियर नहीं होगा. बट व्हेन आई गॉट इन देयर वाज अ हार्श रियलिटी, राइट. मतलब गांव से अगर तुम जा रहे हो तो यू आर नॉट कॉन्फिडेंट, प्लस क्लास इज ऑल्सो प्लेइंग अ मेजर रोल देयर. Then I started interning with an organization called Human Rights Law Network in Mumbai. My major role was to go to court daily. So there I was seeing a particular type of category, right? मतलब किस तरीके के लोग lower courts में आ रहे हैं, trial courts में आ रहे हैं और किस problems के साथ आ रहे हैं. तो that was very much sensitive for me to see कि कितने छोटे मतलब चीज के लिए लोग पूरी अपनी life वहाँ पर courts में बिता रहे हैं, जिनके पास पैसे नहीं है और कुछ नहीं है, कुछ means नहीं है, social capital नहीं है, economic capital नहीं है. अगर मेरा एज अ लॉयर एक्सपीरियंस देखोगे वो जो इंटरसेक्शन है मेरे कास्ट का और जेंडर का तो वो काफी अलग रोल प्ले हो रहा है. जैसे मेरा सरनेम मिश्रा है तो देल जस्ट अगर मैं अपना नाम बताऊंगी तो वो लोग बोले पहले लगेगा मिश्रा, सो देल ट्रीट मी इन अ डिफरेंट वे, नॉट मिश्रा इट्स मिश्रा, राइट. सो देन दे विल आस्क कि व्हाट कास्ट यू राइट एंड then the behavior completely changes. So I can see that pause and awkwardness of some seconds and that change in behavior. I entered there with a very low exposure and low confidence. Okay, so I was, so my first year was very, 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 very bad and depressing. I was not able to make sense ki it is not a personal thing. It's a, you know, matlab, सभी के साथ हो रहा होगा ये दिक्कत, सभी को हो रहा होगा. इट्स नॉट आई एम नॉट द ओनली वन, बट आई डोंट हैव दैट वोकैबुलरी एट दैट टाइम कि मैं कैसे इस बात को कन्वे करूँ और कैसे इस बात को बताऊँ कि आई एम नॉट एबल टू मेक सेंस ऑफ व्हाट इज हैपनिंग इन द स्कूल, राइट. आई फेल्ट कि मेरे में ही कुछ कमी है एंड आई एम नॉट दैट. कॉलेज में मैं कभी ग्रुप नहीं बना पाई हम लोग का. इट्स अ गवर्नमेंट कॉलेज और वहां महाराष्ट्र कम्युनिटीज के बच्चे थे वहां पर, बट सो हम लोग का एक ग्रुप बना बट वी नेवर टॉक्ड अबाउट कास्ट. And then I started working and then I used to stay away from college and hostel. Then at workplace also I was not very much open about my caste. मेरे under confidence को मैंने कभी मेरे caste से relate नहीं किया. मतलब मैं खुद में कर पाती थी, मतलब मैं किसी को बोल नहीं पाई कि कास्ट के बारे में बात करने के लिए भी एक आई थिंक विल नीड दैट प्रिविलेज थोड़ा सा. तुमने आइडेंटिटी बता दिया तो क्या हो जाएगा फिर, और अगर आगे वाले को पता चल गया कि तुम इसके बारे में इतना कॉन्फिडेंटली बात कर रहे हो तो क्या तुम्हारे अपॉर्चुनिटीज चेंज हो जाएंगे, क्या तुम्हारे प्रति बिहेवियर चेंज हो जाएगा, ये सब भी चीज है. सो इतना लॉ कॉलेज में तो मैंने इतना इस पर बात नहीं किया और इतना ग्रुप हम लोग का फॉर्म नहीं हुआ. बट आई डिड वन फेलोशिप इन बैंगलोर, अर्बन फेलोशिप विद इंडियन इंस्टीट्यूट फॉर ह्यूमन सेटलमेंट्स. They took 4 people from marginalized communities. We out of 30, we 4 were from Dalit background. So we 4 formed a group. In that fellowship, I was very much open and I openly talked about my caste, my class, my experiences, my insecurities, my fear and everything. So I shared that. And with CPA also, I'm very much glad that I can talk about all these things with Nikita especially. I'll not say that we are working for that community of people. We are working for our community here. I am not only working here, I am so emotionally involved with the work I'm doing here. And I'm glad that CPA has given me a space to open that and, you know, and tell that I'm not feeling comfortable or comfortable with this work or I'm emotionally feeling low. So good that this space is created so that we can work also and share also. CPA is trying to put forward the question of caste, how it's related or interconnected or its intersection with the carcerality. I was handling cases, I was going to court, we were doing pro bono cases and all stuff like that. Yeah. But here what we are trying to do is whenever we are doing any case or whenever we're handling any case, we're trying to put forward the question of caste. Lawyers here are trying to tell us that we should not always bring forward the question of caste. It's not like that. We don't need to always bring caste forward.
A real conspiracy of silence involves truth that people in power have agreed to keep quiet. The realities and facts and statistics that are suppressed, hidden and hushed over. The active malevolence inscribed, programmed, bound into the very workings of state machinery.
Jai Hind, Jai Shri Ram, Jai Ma Durga, Jai Ma Kali, Bharat Mata Ki Jai!
Every time India debates the death penalty, the rhetoric is shrill and violent, but lacking in facts. Facts on how the death penalty actually works in India. On prisoners, their trials, their backgrounds. But now for the first time, a comprehensive report seeks to examine the lives of those on death row in India. In 24 hours this week, we bring you the Death Penalty Project. The National Law School in Delhi
Students at this university were given the option to work for a unique project, part of the Death Penalty Center.
Under the center, we have the Death Penalty Research Project and the Death Penalty Litigation Clinic. So we started with the research project in June 2013, and the idea was to develop a socioeconomic profile of who gets the death penalty in India and understand the experience of India's death row prisoners with the criminal justice system.
In 2013, a core team of 11 students led by Professor Anoop Surendranath, director of the Death Penalty Center, began to travel across India to find both hard data and conduct a qualitative study on what it means to be on death row in India.
Studying humanities, it was also a time for me to make sense of and like the process of assertion of my own caste identity and meaning making of it began. And I was always very keen on making sense of the law because I thought at that point, of course, and quite naively so in hindsight perhaps, that I thought it was this really powerful tool of social change and all. And I mean, of course, I'm not as deluded as I was then, but I still think there is value to engaging with the law and the language of the law particularly. That's how I decided to go to law school. And my first year of law school is when I worked on the death penalty project. And that experience for me, I think, was extremely formative in shaping the way that I look at criminal justice. Because it was very evident that there were some people who were just designed to fall through the cracks of the system, and that in that context, then it was evident that there were only a certain kind of people from a certain strata of society who wound up on death row. And I think, of course, back then I couldn't articulate it as clearly, but it almost seemed like everything was leading up to them being in that situation, you know, because we met their families, we met their lawyers, and it's like an entire system had conspired to make sure that they'd end up on the gallows. That experience was really what pushed me to then do like the other things that I did. I worked with a group of lawyers in Chhattisgarh in this place called Bastar, which is, you know, rife with Maoist insurgency. I mean, even there, all of these things just kept becoming clearer to me that what I thought was somewhat like a tool for social change, or it was just very evident that it was being used to perpetuate the hierarchies that already existed, right? And it became very evident to me that for the state, like, criminal law was sort of their weapon to come down on people in various ways. So whether it was curbing dissent or denying people their rights, making sure that there were a certain kind of people who were suffering from incarceration, or who in so many ways were like the only ones that were paying the price for any kind of wrongdoing that they had done. So it was very evident that there was a certain kind of like maintenance of social order function. It was like making sure that the hierarchies that exist were not disrupted in any way. It became gradually clearer that these are hierarchies of caste, because that articulation didn't exist, or even now doesn't particularly exist in the Indian context, right? Like, it's just this sort of vague phrasing of, oh, you know, poor people are ending up in jail, poor people's rights are violated. It's almost like there is some nebulous category of the poor that exists in this country. We make it seem like it's an ahistorical category. For me, particularly when I moved to Bhopal, it just became so evident, especially with like the Vimuktas, because they're a group who were very, very clearly criminalized and deemed to be criminals by birth. And that sort of classification happened because, you know, these are people who are a challenge to the caste system, and that rationale for their criminalization was borrowed from there, right? Like, they challenged the colonial system in various ways, but the rationale for their criminalization came from the caste system. So like, coloniality almost like ascribed itself to caste. So they didn't have to do much in terms of determining how do we maintain social order, because like, that sort of mechanism for how social order is maintained was already laid out for them. Because all of the critiques that I had read up until that point were, we have a colonial system and we've been saddled with this colonial system, and it's almost like these people came and just dumped this system onto us and now we're having to make do with it, right?
Before we were all completely fine and there was no problem.
And before it was all fine and then now they've come and saddled us with this system and our lives are miserable because it's a bit of a necessary evil. But like, we need it to do better, so how can we make it do better? Because to me, as a person who was going to the police station every day, it was just obvious. Like, one would have to make an inordinate amount of effort to overlook this. The only reason those who haven't seen it is because they've chosen to unsee it. Because it's really right there.
According to the National Crime Records Bureau, every third inmate in India is either Dalit or Adivasi. When the number of Dalit and Adivasi prisoners is collated, it forms around a third of all Indian jails, while the population of these communities in India is 25%.
And I'll read down the observations that have been made by the court that the riots which shook the national capital of the country in February 2020 evidently did not take place in the spur of the moment, and the conduct of the protesters who are present in the video footage, that it is a large calculated attempt to dislocate the functioning of the government as well as to disrupt the normal life of people in the city. In fact, the court goes on to say that this also confirms the existence of a pre-planned, and please note this, that it's a pre-planned and premeditated conspiracy.
Land by Aga Shahid Ali. Swear by the olive and the God-kissed land, there is no sugar in the promised land. Why must the bars turn neon now when love, I'm already drunk in your capitalist land? If home is found on both sides of the globe, home is of course here, and always a missed land. The hours come to redeem the pledge, not wholly. In fates long years ago we made a tryst land. Clearly these men were here only to destroy. A mosque now, the dust of a prejudiced land. Will the doomsayers die, bitten with envy, when springtime returns to our dismissed land? The prisons fill with the cries of children. Then how do you subsist? How do you persist, land? Is my love nothing, for I've borne no children? I'm with you, Sappho, in that anarchist land. A hurricane is born when the wings flutter. Where will the butterfly on my wrist land? You made me wait for one who wasn't even there, though summer had finished in that tourist land. Do the blind hold temples close to their eyes when we steal their gods for our atheist land? Abandoned bride, night throws down her jewels, so Rome on our descent is an amethyst land. At the moment the heart turns terrorist. Are Shaheed's arms broken, O promised land?
I have read de Kalm's again and again, and there is still the gap between the political and the psychological. How do I treat this kind of psychosis, a political psychosis? I see how F.S. should think and feel, and the difference between that and his present state of mind. But how do I educate him so he can think positively? De Kalm says that the core of disaffection is a negative condition which must be filled with positive ideas. But this does not fit dear Flores. The gap is not in him.
Shreeja Rao, a brilliant young law student and freelance writer from the community, from my community, recently wrote a blistering op-ed for The Quint about Kangana Ranaut's horrid new show Lock Up, spelled for some indecipherable reason with two P's. She noted that Lock Up isn't just a reality television show, it's a representation of the larger realities of the Modi regime. It is the perfect metaphor for the right-wing's mind-numbingly bland script of denial and romanticization that capitalizes on marginalized people's struggles. It turns their woes into an amusing game for the privileged to munch their popcorn over.
I don't want to say state alone, okay, because I feel like usually when you say state also, it's very easy to so then conflate it with the government or like the sort of formal structure, right? Yeah. But like I also see, think that there are people who are deriving power from this system, which is the system of caste. I think they are as much the state as anybody. We have arrived at this situation now with the death penalty for so many offenses on the book, and one huge credit for that goes to the so-called feminist movement in this country. That said, we need harsher criminal laws. This is the state manifesting in different ways.
आप अपने घर, कारोबार और भोपाल शहर को सुरक्षित रखने में पुलिस का सहयोग करना चाहते हैं, तो आइए शुरुआत करें अपने घर, दुकान, कारोबार, परिसर में सीसीटीवी इंस्टॉल करें। पुलिस की निगाह बन जाता है आपका लगाया ये सीसीटीवी और अपराधी को पकड़वाता है रिकॉर्ड करके सबूत सभी। आप भी अपराध पर लगाम लगाने आज ही भोपाल आए बने। अपने घर कारोबार के अंदर बाहर सीसीटीवी लगवाकर भोपाल आई ऐप पर रजिस्टर करें। भोपाल आई, चप्पे चप्पे की निगरानी, अपराधियों की परेशानी।
I was also thinking of people who are the state, like I was thinking of the Bhopal Eye program.
Yeah.
Has that already started?
Oh yeah. They have started reaching out to upper caste people, saying, you know, trying to recruit them. It's not a lot of effort also, no? Like you just have to, anyway the Savarna case exists, right. You just now have to put cameras to it. If there's a theft that happens, the first square finger will be pointed at like the domestic worker, at the watchman, at this, that. So now the state is just like, now we are going to give you a camera for that so that it can aid the process, help you in your existing pursuit, right? Why has that whole system been built, right? It's been built to, which goes back to the point that we've been making, which is that this is ultimately a system that is a stand-in for all of these people who can't do this themselves. They're their proxy.
I asked once, why is there so much fear? Well, now I know. Why is there no privacy? It is unfair and sordid. I cannot read the classified files kept in her office, though I work with the patients and she does not. Only persons of authority can have secrets. Their secrets are all good, even when they are lies.